Good morning. I'm speaking with Usama Makdizi, a professor of history and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Berkeley, whose research focuses on the cultural and political history of the modern Middle East. Some of his publications include the books Artillery of Heaven, American Missionaries and the Failed Conversion of the Middle East, Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame and the Making of the Modern Arab World, and Faith Misplaced, The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations. With his brothers Sari and Karim Makdizi, he co-hosts the podcast Makdizi Street, which you can find through YouTube, other platforms, and Patreon. Welcome to KABU, Usama Makdizi.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Lori.
Well, the Makdizi Street podcast is fantastic political journalism that we want KABU listeners to know about. You and Sari and Karim Makdizi interview noted scholars, journalists, and human rights activists such as Sarah Leah Whitson, Avi Shlaim, Nora Erekat, and most recently, Bassel Megdadi, who provided a fascinating discussion of the importance of Palestinian football. How did you and your brothers, all academics, decide to enter the world of podcasts back in November 2023, I believe?
Well, I think it's a thank you. That's a great question. And I think we often ask ourselves that as well. I mean, we started right after the genocide began, and we had been thinking about it or toying with the idea of starting a podcast, but we kept deferring and deferring and deferring. And then eventually, once the genocide began, and we were, of course, appalled by, as so many, I'm sure, of your listeners, and so many people around the world, we were appalled by the mainstream lack of fairness and any sense of justice or history or context of what was happening to the Palestinians. And so we decided to pool our sort of our knowledge, to pool our passion, to pool our sense of justice, and to start this podcast. And we think of it honestly less as political journalism and more as public scholarship, in the sense of trying to sort of bring in as many guests and also have discussions amongst the three of us, because we're, as you noted, we're three brothers. One who is in literature is a specialization. The other is in political economy and environmental studies, and me, I'm a historian. And so the three of us work together, and we all, in a sense, share the same basic outlines in terms of justice for Palestine and justice more generally. And we felt that it was important to get a focused, honest, contextually rich, and historically informed discussion of what was happening in Palestine. And we know, because we've all been working for decades, we know a lot of people in the field and outside, so journalists, historians, scholars, public intellectuals, human rights activists, and even politicians. And so we've asked all these different people to be on the podcast, and we've had an extraordinary reception. At least we get to control what the questions are and what kinds of questions get asked that center Palestinian history and humanity and context.
Yes, and you all bring such deep knowledge of not only Palestine, but the broader Middle East and U.S. foreign policy. And that is, as you say, just such important context to provide to listeners that I really don't know of any other podcast that provides that level of kind of intellectual context as well as debate, which I want to get to in a minute, because that I find is one of my favorite features of the podcast, how you and your brothers will analyze various guests and sometimes debate amongst yourselves what is to be done or you know what any of the guests represent about the region and prospects for Palestine. In many ways, so much social media and so many podcasts such as yours, The Middle East Eye, journalists like Owen Jones and Chris Hedges, and activists like Katie Halper and Hassan Piker have all provided critical voices on behalf of Palestinians like we've never heard before. But these popular collective voices haven't seemed to penetrate mainstream media or U.S. policymakers, which have been incredibly dishonest in continuing to defend Israel. And we've seen no change or very little change in their coverage and policies. But somehow, majorities of populations, even in the U.S., oppose Israel's war. Do you think this growing popular support for Palestinians and greater outrage against Israel's madness have made or will make a difference?
I hope so. I mean, in the end, what we're seeing, of course, is the, for all of us, it's for all of us, we are seeing the first live stream genocide in history. This has never happened before. I mean, there have been genocides in the past, and alas, I'm sure there will be genocides in the future, but this is the first genocide that's been live streamed on TikTok, on YouTube, on Instagram, on all the different social media platforms. And so people around the world, and we're talking about billions of people around the world, are seeing what is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza. And honestly, it's absolutely unacceptable, depraved, unconscionable, cruel, and disgraceful on the part of the Israeli government, on the part of all those in Israel and in the US and in the West who support this kind of outrageous violations of the most fundamental basic norms of human decency. I mean, the targeting of children, the starvation, literally the starvation of children as a deliberate policy, the killing, the massacres, the endless bombings of schools and hospitals and universities and shelters and bakeries. And most of all, the cruelty of because it's all deliberate, it's all systematic policy. It's not like this is a one-day event or a one-off event. And I think people around the world can see all this, and they're shocked. And I think it will, and I hope it has to make a difference. Otherwise, we're in very, very, very dark. We are in, of course, in dark times, but we're heading towards even darker times if all this huge amount of collective outrage doesn't make a difference. And Laurie, what I see now is that it used to be, you know, people didn't know very much about the Palestinians. And even now, a lot of people who are outraged by the genocide are not necessarily sort of deep in knowledge about Palestine or the history of Palestine or what's happened or how did we get to where we are today, but just are at a more fundamental, basic human level are appalled by what is happening. And you're right, this huge amount of outrage, and we're talking about major figures. We're talking about major figures in sports, mostly outside the U.S., unfortunately, but also in the U.S. in terms of alternative social media. As you mentioned, a few of the figures here who are influencing and who are trying to make an impact, but also people like Jeremy Scahill, whom we had on the podcast, Ryan Grimm and others. A lot of people are can see what's happening on our appalled. It doesn't make a difference yet because in the U.S., as we know, the policymakers at the top, as well as the sort of, we can call them the nomenclatura or the elite, who run this country, don't often just ignore public opinion until they're absolutely forced to do a change. And that's where we are now with the question of Palestine. The U.S. policy under Biden and now under Trump is extraordinarily cruel and extraordinarily anti-Palestinian. And it's building on quite literally a century of U.S. policy that has been dismissive, not to say blatantly hostile, to Palestinian aspirations for a better life and for a more decent future.
I mean, I think the fact that the Trump administration has, well, along with university administrators, clamped down on protesters and really tried to silence and deport those who are criticizing U.S. policy suggests that, you know, they're really trying to stamp out this, you know, these powerful voices because they fear that change. But just recently,
Laurie, could I say that? But they're building the Trump administration, as vile as these policies are in targeting students and in arresting people throughout this country. And again, not just Palestinians, but of course, this all began with the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil of Colombia. With the, as far as I'm aware, and as far as most of us can see, with the tacit complicity of or the tacit consent of the Columbia University administrators who allowed this to happen or have said very little, at the very least, have said very little in defense of their students and, in fact, have enacted extraordinarily hostile policies towards any expressions of solidarity with the Palestinians. So it's not just the Trump administration, it's the Biden administration, it's university administrators before Trump came to power, and he's taking advantage. He and the right wing and the conservative movement in this, well, let's just say the right wing movement in this country, at least the right wing people in power right now, have taken advantage of the smearing, the consistent smearing by organizations like the ADL of our students, of all faiths, by the way, to ram through a clear right-wing agenda that's initially aimed at Palestinians and expressions of solidarity with Palestine, but of course is a much broader agenda.
Right, right. Absolutely. And I mean, yes, under the Biden administration, you know, the Biden, of course, began this genocide and also so-called liberal college administrators completely complicit in trying to erase any kind of academic freedom or freedom of speech in criticizing Israel. And we see this here in Portland, and in fact, a local school board member in Beaverton has been under investigation for even acknowledging or expressing sympathy for Palestinians and acknowledging the genocide.
In our lifetime, we will be free. One day when the light shines, we will be free. In our lifetime, we will be free. And they can bury us, but they will find out we are seeds. Because I know of every massacre we suffered, the Nakba, Sabra, Shatila, and Rafa. My people have died a million times in the struggle, still they rise from the tide like a rose through the rubble. I see God himself in the eye of a refugee who'd rather die.
That was Macklemore's Hens Hall featuring Anis, MC Abdul, and Amerzan. The song commemorates the Columbia University student uprising for Gaza and the life and death of 5-year-old Palestinian Hind Rajab, who was killed by Israeli Defense Forces after being trapped for hours in a car with 6 dead family members. Red Crescent Emergency Services spoke with Hind for hours while she awaited rescue before being killed, along with 2 ambulance drivers who were dispatched to rescue her. This is KBOO Portland. I'm Desiree Helgers, and I'm your host for today's Oldham Variety Hour, where we're in the midst of our summer fun drive. You know you can count on KBOO to bring you courageous, uncensored coverage of what's going on in the Middle East and of the global movement to stop the unfolding genocide in Gaza and to free Palestine. To donate to KBOO, go to kboo.fm/give to make a one-time gift or become a monthly sustaining member. You can also click the red box Donate in the mobile app or text KBOO to 44321. That's text KBOO to 44321. Finally, you can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. And now back to Lori Mercier speaking with Osama Makdizi.
I remember when you and your brothers were debating whether Trump represented a break from the U.S. foreign policy establishment. I mean, I think that was maybe early in the administration, and perhaps hoping or wishful thinking that there might be some change in U.S. policies. But Huckabee just, you know, echoed Trump the other day about millions of Palestinians are not only going to have to leave Gaza, but the West Bank. So I'm wondering, has your thinking changed about some of these debates that you all were having some months ago?
Well, I don't think, to be fair, I don't think we were debating the good intentions of the Trump administration, and certainly not people like Mike Huckabee, but not Donald Trump or any of the people in this administration. None of us have any sort of are under any illusions about just how anti-Palestinian this administration is. The question was, The question was, to what extent is the Trump administration building upon what the Biden administration gave them in terms of a platform of genocide? And to what extent is there going to be a break insofar as Trump is ultimately not entirely ideological in the sense of, he does what Trump wants to do. And he can, as we saw with Elon Musk, this whole sort of flip-flop with Elon Musk. I mean, these are sort of extremely. So we had, as I said, we have no faith. It's not that we have any faith in the positive intentions of any of these people. On the other hand, it's the situation in Gaza has gotten worse, and of course, but the point is, it's been getting worse for decades, and then a massive escalation from October onwards. And it gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And more people are aware of this. And that's why you see so many different personalities in the public sphere, academics, but mostly sort of, I would say, also writers and journalists on the in the social media sphere that you referred to, sports personalities, even the manager of one of the largest clubs in the football clubs in the world, Manchester City, Pep Guardiola. At a graduation commence at a graduation ceremony, spoke out Miss Rachel, in terms of on YouTube. There are all these people who are speaking out, and what's amazing is how many people are speaking out because of what is happening in Gaza, because it's so unconscionable, because what Israel is doing is so shocking and so depraved and so cynical and so deliberate. And that's the key point. It's deliberate. And at the same time, you have an extraordinarily right-wing government in this country building upon the democratic establishment that have green-lighted this genocide. And that's where we are.
Yes. And despite this live stream genocide and universal condemnation of Israel by all human rights organizations, ICJ, the ICC, just the record bombing, the unprecedented targeting of journalists, scholars, aid workers, medical professionals. But yet, I want to turn here to our academic organizations like the American Historical Association, which has resisted even something as basic as condemning scholasticide. But what do you make of historians and, I mean, of all people and professions who supposedly depend on evidence for their assessments, refusing to condemn U.S. support of Israel?
Well, I
I
think
mean,
there's
certainly it's not all historians, and
yeah.
maybe you could talk about this controversy in the AHA.
Yes, I think it's important to sort of underscore that point, which is that the scholasticide for your listeners and viewers, scholasticide, of course, means the deliberate sort of destruction of the scholarly, the higher education, and the education system in Gaza. Israel has destroyed, deliberately destroyed every single university in Gaza. And has, of course, targeted schools and has made learning and teaching impossible in Gaza. It's also killed administrators, it's killed teachers, it's killed students in Gaza over the past 2 years. And so, historians are, many historians have been outraged. And of course, again, just to emphasize this point, it's not just Palestinian historians or historians who work on Palestine, it's ethical people who care deeply about the fact that history has been absolutely weaponized from the very beginning by Netanyahu and his crew, and of course before Netanyahu, by the entire Zionist project in Palestine. History has been weaponized against the Palestinian people to claim that some people have more rights on this land than others based on religion, based on the fact that some people, and excluding the indigenous native population of the Palestinians. And it's been a system of oppression that goes back. It goes back to at least 1917, if not the Balfour Declaration, if not the mandate itself in the 1920s, and of course the Nakba of 1948. There's a long history of this, and historians are deeply aware of this. And so a lot of the younger historians are appalled. A lot of the senior historians, I would say, some of them are appalled. I should hope many more are appalled. But the leadership of the AHA, the American Historical Association, which is the flagship professional organization for historians working on history in the United States, took it extraordinarily. First of all, the membership there voted overwhelmingly to censure the scholasticide, to condemn the scholasticide, to condemn Israel's scholasticide of and the destruction of every university in Gaza. The leadership of the AHA, however, vetoed that democratic decision on the part of the membership. Not only did they veto it, they refused to put it to a vote, to a general vote to the entire membership. And so it showed the level of cowardice, the level of duplicity, the level of extraordinary disingenuousness on the part of those in power at the AHA. And because especially when one bears in mind that the American Historical Association condemned Russia immediately upon its invasion of Ukraine, but
for all of its crimes, hardly a genocide.
Well, whatever it is, they still condemned it. The point is they condemned it right away. And the extraordinary thing is that they claimed, well, that is about history and the abuse of history. But with Israel, they said, no, you know, it's not about the abuse of history. Never mind Netanyahu's references to Amalek. Never mind Netanyahu's references to Judea and Samaria. Never mind the way Palestinians have been depicted as you know, primitive and savage and uncivilized and so on and so forth. Never mind the whole history of Western genocides against non-Western peoples, you know, and the, I mean, there's a whole thing. And so I think many younger scholars understand this. And what we see across the board in virtually all professions that I'm aware of is a generation shift, a massive tectonic generation shift. Younger people, by and large, don't buy the propaganda that is so utterly dehumanized Palestinians. Older scholars, more established scholars, those who crave power, those who want to be in positions of influence, understand and feel that there are certain, either they don't care about Palestinians, or they're just deeply anti-Palestinian, or they're just afraid, or they simply, you know, they do the calculations and they figure it's not worth it to take on those who are in favor of maintaining the status quo and maintaining this truly obscene anti-Palestinian discourse in the United States.
How have you fared at the University of California? I mean, what are your observations about solidarity among faculty in support of Palestinian rights?
Same. What I said earlier, I think, applies across the board. I think across the entire United States and probably across most of the Western world, in the sense that there is a generation shift taking place. There is a huge demand and thirst for knowledge. But as you said, as we started at the outset of this program, we've never seen this level of repression. Not in my lifetime, and I'm sure in your lifetime, we've never, ever seen this level of repression in the United States against students in this way. It's kind of absolutely shocking. It's absolutely, utterly shocking what's been happening. So students are understandably nervous about protesting now. But the amazing thing is how many students of all faiths have continued to protest, have continued to raise their voices, have continued to try to bring awareness to the genocide and to the complicity of many institutions in this country with the genocide. And what we've seen, in fact, is kind of shocking. We've seen a doubling down of denial across the United States, especially in official institutions that are pretending. I mean, we can see what's going on now. There's this whole, what's happened is that the U.S., the Congress, have these hearings about anti-Semitism on our campuses, and they've literally sort of, you know, they have created this narrative that solidarity with Palestinians and protests against genocide is somehow anti-Semitism. Yeah. And that's what they have said over and over and over again. And our administrators, by and large, have responded by being on the defensive. And this is, if I'm going to give them, you know, if one is going to be generous, by being on the defensive and by desperately trying to parry all these attacks on their institutions. And so what we see, by and large, is that younger generations no longer accept that there should be a Palestine exception, whereas those in power are adamant that they want to maintain the Palestine exception. In other words, make the Palestinians people who don't deserve equality, don't deserve history, don't deserve humanity, don't deserve rights, don't deserve liberation, and don't deserve ethical consideration.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Osama Makdizi. I really encourage listeners to check out the Makdizi Brothers podcast, Makdizi Street, available on YouTube, other platforms, and Patreon. And we'll look forward to hearing more from you. I hope, Osama, that you plan to continue these podcasts.
For the time being, we are. Yeah, thank you.
Well, we'll link to it and your other work on the Old Mole Variety Hour website on KBOO. Thanks again.
Thank you, Lori. You take care.
Still they know they can't shake us. $1 billion sword to the neck. Death cannot break us. And every Palestinian refugee holds a key. One day we will return, no matter how long it takes us. Time we will be free.
That was Macklemore's Hens Hall featuring Anis, MC Abdul, and Emerson. And before that, you were listening to Lori Mercier's interview with Osama Makdizi.